through. Amen. Well, welcome, everybody. You know, I'm not sure, we're going into this Lenten, we're finishing up this Lenten season, and it's often a time for reflection for people as they think about their lives, and I've thought about mine. Something's come out and been true, and this has actually been true for pretty much everybody I know, which is, if they're honest, there's something about themselves, something about their lives, something about who they are that they would love to change. Like, you see this around, you know, New Year's, you see this around this time. Anytime there's like a point of reflection, I think that this is something, whether it's like an addiction we'd like to see overcome, a bad habit, sometimes like weight loss, as we referenced earlier, we want to develop better money management. Or maybe it's like wanting to change in the sense of like find resolution or healing in like a past hurt. Or perhaps it's like, I want to change my job, or I want to find more meaning or balance in life. And it's my guess that if I took a second and you reflected, it would not take you very long to think of probably several things that if you could, you would change. And I think we also see like tons of organizations that recognize this too, like Weight Watchers or the entire like self-help industry. And honestly, I think I see this at the core of a lot of faith communities. Like you look at church mission statements. I took like a quick look at some of the churches I knew, and you get things like introducing people to the life-changing power of God's mercy and truth, helping people find new life and renewed experience of life, helping people live impossibly good lives, to transform lives and renew our city. Those are real mission statements of churches. Or ours here, which is helping people find deeper, fuller, more connected lives. All of those are change statements. And I think what these churches and these organizations and these industries understand is that a feeling of being a different person today than I was yesterday is a core experience of feeling alive. But at the same time, experiencing lasting and meaningful change in life is just really hard. That we may want to change something, but we don't be able to just decide and make it happen. That we seem to need some kind of help. And that's something these industries and organizations and churches seem to see their role in some ways to help those things. Help us see what those changes need to be and help us foster those changes through. But it's hard. It's not an easy thing to change. And according to the American Psychological Association, they highlighted the 6 most common reasons we struggle to change. And I find them particularly insightful, so I'll just share them here with you. The first one, we struggle to change because we rely on negative emotions for motivation. Well, it's understandable to think that strongly felt negative emotions like regret, shame, fear, guilt, like they should be able to catalyze a lasting change, the opposite is actually true. That these emotions actually stunt growth. They're the kinds of things that whatever change that shame brings is usually very short-lived. The second most common reason that we fail to change is the mistake of thinking knowing is everything, when in fact knowing is not everything. We think that just by knowing something is bad, if somebody explains to us, present us new facts, I think we can look at our world today and realize new facts don't actually change very much. New information does not change a lot. But we think, you know what, if I just understand this is something I shouldn't do, then logically I'll follow through and that will change. If we look at our opening video, again referencing the writer is, the rational part of our brain is greatly outmatched by the emotional part. And then number 3, I guess psychologists like elephant analogies. This was another one, which is we try to eat the entire elephant in one bite. Change is a big thing, an elephant, if you will. But no matter what it is, it's almost never possible to just take it in one bite. Change very rarely happens overnight. And we often forget that failure is often a part of change. All of the most trusted models of change factor in failure as part of the process. It is a process for change. And we're encouraged to consider failure not as a total disregard for what's happening, but a step, not an excuse to stop trying. The 4th reason that we most commonly fail to actually change is we neglect the toolbox. You call them tools, devices, supports, whatever you'd like. The point is we need reliable go-tos to support sustained change. And that's, again, I was like, sustained change. And most people aren't interested in having a change that lasts a week or a month. Most of the changes we want to make are things we want to experience for a lifetime. So, like, let's say we want to change our diet. At a minimum, we need to, as a tool, understand what kind of diet we want to have. We want to create a strategy, an approach. Perhaps we create a cheat sheet to help us understand it. Perhaps we create reminders of what we're trying to accomplish in a day. We need a toolbox if we want to rely on that change sticking. You know, and honestly, one of the most commonly neglected tools are the people in our lives. How much of a difference it makes to involve a buddy when you're trying to change, or a community of support. The fifth reason, I kind of like this one, for some reason it just resonates with me, is we don't actually want to change. We do not find success in changing if we're only changing because we think we should, or because of outside pressure. External pressure to change does not work in the long haul. It only produces quick, short-lived experiences. You know, I think of significant others, and you'll hear, you know, in the world people say, well, if he only loved me, if she only loved me, they would stop doing that thing, or they'd start doing that thing. And the reality is it actually isn't about the amount of love or lack of love that is felt. It's about whether that significant other actually believes they need to change. That it has to be something we desire for ourselves. And even if somebody makes a convincing argument, even if we have a ton of external pressure for us to change, that will only last as long as that pressure holds us in. And often it will lead us to hiding those things rather than actually changing them. And then finally, according to the APA, the number one reason people fail to change is they try to change too many things. If you can commit to changing one behavior long-term and make it stick, like, that is commendable. Behavior change is hard. But trying to take on multiple behaviors at one time is a surefire way to make sure that they all fail. So the resources we use to bring about change, like that motivation, the attention, the self-control, willpower, even with the support of other people, those are finite energies. We don't have exponential motivation. We don't have, those are finite things. Like, I just read a study of, if you break up your morning routine, you will be less productive at work that day. Because the motivation to focus in at work, rather than being on an autopilot that morning and then being able to focus at work, you used up willpower that morning, changing up your morning routine, and thus people were less productive at work. It's a finite thing. And so if you're trying to change 2, 3, 4, 5 things about who you are, that's just more than you can tackle. And so the number one reason we fail to change is we are trying to change too many things at once, according to the American Psychological Association. I find these fascinating. I don't know if you do. Each one of these resonates with me in a different way when I think of the failed attempts I've made at changing things about who I am, changing things about how I think. And what strikes me as a pastor is how many of these things I've experienced in churches trying to motivate me to change. I was a pastor, I'm always thinking about, like, how does this work in church? And as I read this list, I was like, I'm pretty sure that is the 6 most common ways I've experienced change encouraged at churches. And that was sad for me. It's sad. Not all churches. This is clearly not true of all churches. Some churches have great legacies of bringing about encouraging lasting change in people's life. But frankly, I don't think it is the majority. In my experience, being in and out of churches and having lots of friends that are pastors, it seems to me that the general approach to encouraging change is to take the 52 Sundays in a year. So you have 52 Sundays. And then in your sermons, you encourage change by picking out, like, the top 30 to 40 things, whether they're bad behaviors, bad beliefs, bad thought process. So you present the bad thing, and then you propose 30 to 40 over those 52 Sundays, because there's some repeats. Like, you can't just, you know, it's not 52 separate. Like, you got to hit sex, like, 4 times. And then you propose 30 to 40 new good behaviors, new good beliefs, new good thought processes. These kind of rules for life. And my experience is the Bible then becomes the kind of support system for the rule of the day. So this is the thing I'm addressing for today, and this is where the Bible helps support what I'm saying of why this is bad and why I'm presenting this as good. And I guess to me, it's no wonder why probably the most common misconception of the Bible is that it should be treated as a rule book or a code of conduct, which it absolutely was not intended to be. But it makes sense that that would be the case, because if the people that are teaching us from the Bible each week, if pastors on Sundays are teaching us the rule of the week from the Bible, it's just going to be logical to think that's how I should read the Bible. But let's just take a minute and let's resort back to those six things again. Look at the six most common reasons we approach change and fail. And I just want to take for a moment and take as a given that every church we've ever been in, or we know about, wants us to live impossibly good lives. And anything they suggest is a pure suggestion for care for you, that they want you to live a life that God desires for you because they want good for you. And then very generously, let's say they're correct on their suggestions. It strikes me that even very generously granting all of that, this approach to encouraging change for people undermines how real change happens. Like in general, my experience is change is relying a lot on information. I'm gonna tell you why this is bad, and if you understand why this is bad, then you will change. My experience is it's a lot of reliance on negative emotions. Like, don't you feel terrible for how that worked? You should totally not do that again. Like, there's whole processes of, like, when you're introducing people to faith, is first you convince them of how bad their behavior is. So they first have to understand how bad it is. And there's a way that that works, that it's relying on it. Well, if I feel guilty enough, that will motivate change. Or even just the fact that in general you're hitting 30 to 40 subjects, that means about every week or so I'm introducing a new area for you to change. So that's only giving you a week or two to eat that elephant, and then presenting you in a year 30 to 40 things for you to consider changing. That is like way more than we could possibly ever tackle. And this is assuming that you want to change in the first place, and that you have a life set up with tools around you to support any change that happens. So that is not a kind picture of American churches, and it's not likely. It is because my own unhappiness is hard to hide. Out of all the things that I think about that leave me the most angry, it is that churches communicate explicitly, we are here to help you change, but in practice seem completely unaware of how human behavior and change actually happens. It makes me angry that people are trying to encourage the most important things in your life, which is you becoming a fuller experience of who you are, seeing the thing God wants for you, pursuing those things, leaving behind the things that are destructive to you, and finding the things that bring life to you. But then in practice, presented in a way that actually undermines that. It makes me angry. And so if I have a harsh tone, it's because I feel harsh. And so I apologize if that comes out. That's just my own deficit here. And again, to say, not true of every church, but it is a fair critique, I think, of many. Interestingly enough, when I talk to pastors, friends of mine, and we talk about, you know, change is a big thing. Like, how are you moving people along in their life? How are you encouraging change in the areas that need change? Common conversation amongst pastor circles. What's interestingly is almost no pastor I talk to thinks that making moral absolute statements in a sermon, you know, those 30 to 40 things, actually creates change. Almost none of them actually believe on a Sunday morning saying lying is bad actually helps people not lie. When they'll say things, you know, real change happens on one-on-one pastoring or spiritual direction, or change happens in the context of a small group, or commonly somebody will have a spiritual experience of God where it feels like a change is initiated in their life. That's how change happens. Great, I agree with that. But my question is if we agree that these 30 to 40 moral absolute statements don't actually create change, why is this so prevalent? And the answer I get back makes me feel sad. The answer I get back is usually some version of the most vocal people in my church want me to say those things. Almost every pastor I know talks about the pressure they feel from people in their church to make a statement about something, to be clear about something, to make sure that everybody leaves that room knowing that this is right and this is wrong. And I know several pastors that have made statements that actually go beyond what they personally feel. But they did it because they felt like the people, or at least the most vocal people in their church, were asking them to do. You know, I have a pastor I spoke to recently about this, and they told me that he's gotten in way more trouble for not saying things on a Sunday than any controversial thing he's ever said. There's this sense in a religious setting that the worst thing you can do is let somebody leave the room thinking that they're still right. The worst thing you can do is let somebody leave that room with a behavior or a belief that is still wrong, or at least not clearly knowing you disapprove of it. Like to walk out of here, keep doing that thing you're doing, to keep believing that thing you're believing. If I haven't done everything I can to make it clear I disapprove, if I haven't done everything I can to make it clear that that is wrong, that I have somehow failed my responsibility to God. There's a real pressure that, I don't know if you resonate with that. I don't know if that's, I doubt that's just a thing that pastors feel. My guess is if you particularly grew up in a religious setting, there's some sense of like, what if that person leaves here and they think that that thing they're doing is still okay? Like there's a sense, I felt that for much of my life. And let alone how terrible that is for that person that we are supposedly making it clear for what is right and wrong, I find it so corrosive to my soul. That it's on me to change that person's behavior, or at the very least, it's my responsibility to make it clear I disapprove. Frankly, I just don't see Jesus doing anything like that. Like, literally nowhere do I see Jesus acting that way. Jesus became famous and controversial for his unconditional embrace and acceptance, his embrace of people to say, yeah, you're kind of messed up, but I love you, just keep coming. Not his exclusion and disapproval. In fact, the only people he made it clear he disapproved of before they walked away were religious people doing that exact kind of thing. You know, there's this picture that Jesus got angry a lot. You know what? Sometimes he did, but he didn't get angry at the person that walked out of that room thinking they were still okay. He got angry at the religious people that were trying to make it really clear that everybody else had something wrong. You know, it's just like the famous saying of Jesus, make sure people do not leave the room unaware of the speck in their eye, but totally don't worry about the plank in yours. You know, it's in my experience that the people that most commonly speak up about this are people that feel comfortable that they don't have much to change. I can't think of a single experience that was like, I'm sad you didn't make that clear because I really needed to be challenged there. It is always, I'm sad you didn't make it clear because I think that other person needed to hear that their life is wrong. Again, emotions and anger are coming out of me because to me, if we care about change, if Vince is doing something that needs to be different, I don't serve him by making it clear I disapprove. I serve him by helping him change in a way that actually works. Let alone the fact that I believe I'm the one that knows what's the right thing to change right now. If I can only change one thing at a time, I'm aware that this is the thing he needs to change. The arrogance. Sorry, a little anger. But here comes the redemptive turn in my sermon. I brought us down here, guys. And I'm going to try to pull us back up here. Because the truth is, we can find change we need in life. Change is hard, but it is possible. People do find recovery from addiction. People do lose weight. People do find hope and meaning in life. People do quit bad habits and start good ones. People do find love and belonging. People do find healing from their wounds and a hope for the future. Change does happen. How? Well, according to, in psychology, what's known as the stages of change model, All lasting change. Again, I could care less if you want to change something today, if it doesn't mean you're still going to be changed in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years. No change is good if it lasts 10 minutes. Lasting change happens in stages. So according to the stages of change model in psychology, the way lasting change happens is through stages. The first stage being pre-contemplation. It's an unconscious processing that perhaps a behavior has become problematic. You actually have no intention on changing that behavior, and you're actually not fully aware of it, but just something inside of you is starting to see an awareness that perhaps this thing is not serving me. And then that moves on to contemplation. You're now actively aware that something's problematic. You're not actually quite at the change point there, but you begin weighing the pros and cons. Like, pro, I will be healthier. Con, I don't get to eat as many cheeseburgers. Like, you were weighing those two things. And then preparation. You have decided, no, this is the change I'm making. And you begin to plan a process for that change. And then that leads to action. Okay, now I have a plan in place for this change, and I am going to take a step towards that. And you begin following through with your plan for change. And then maintenance. You are doing things to maintain that change, using the supports, the tools in your life to sustain whatever change has happened. And then in every change model in psychology that holds weight, you have the step of relapse. You can relapse at any stage, but this should not be seen as failure, but part of a process. After you relapse, you can re-enter at any place here. And I just love this. It feels so true. I don't know how many times you've ever tried to change something. I mean, something that felt hard. And I'm kind of an all-in, all-out kind of person. So I can't tell you how many times I've been like, well, I missed a day exercising, so I might as well take the month off. It's part of the process, especially the things that matter most. And you know what? If we go back to that idea of how negative emotions actually do the opposite of motivate change, if we feel shame over our relapse, if that's our primary emotion, if I have failed, and that becomes the narrative we believe, it will actually circumvent the lasting change. And so it's not to say, oh, it's great, you know, you didn't do that thing you wanted to do, that's 4 stars. But it's saying, you know what, this is part of the process. And just because I failed once does not mean I have failed in this change. You look at this. That is not a small process. That's not a small thing. Like, no wonder we can't manage one, or maybe the most capable of us, 2 areas of change at a time. And that's why I think it becomes important that we are focusing on the correct area of change for right now. Where we need to make sure we're approaching the thing that is the right thing for us to approach right now. Like, we often will have a glaring area of change, but that may not actually be the first right step for us. And this all gets me thinking about a famous passage from the Bible, something that Paul wrote in his letter to the church in Rome. It makes me think a lot of particularly that first step of pre-contemplation, where we aren't fully aware, but there's like something in us that is stirring that maybe something's not right here. And so if you want to read with me, this is in your program. This is Paul writing to the church in Rome, in Romans 8, starting in verse 26. In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us through wordless groans. And he who searches our heart knows the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for God's people in accordance with the will of God. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Man, I love that. Like, I really love that. And just that last line of God works for the good of all who love him, I don't take that as, so therefore, your life is all good if you love him. it means the things God is working on is not a call for you just to be more obedient. It's not just a call for him to feel more powerful because he gets you to do what you want. It's because he wants your good. And so anything and everything that God calls us to is for our good. Those two things are not in contradiction. Even the hardest things we will do in life, if God is walking us through it, it is because it is good for us. I love the picture of this, though, of like, I have no idea where to start. Like, I am aware of so many flaws. I am aware of so many habits. I am aware of so many things about myself that are not ideal. I don't even know where to begin. I'm not even aware of all of them. I don't know what I should start now and what I need to put on the back burner. But God searches my heart, even when I don't know. And he intercedes on my behalf. The millions of things I need to change, the weaknesses I have all over the place, he is interceding for them. He is working on them. I can trust that he is working on them. The call isn't for me to figure out how to get my life perfect, to create the task list of this area I need to work on, then this area I need to work on, then this area I need to work on, and that's my plan. My task is to trust he is interceding and to look where he is leading right now. What is the thing for me today? And then trust, because he wants good for me, that that is the right thing. Even if that's not the loudest thing. And my experience has been true. That God is good and he backs this up. I think of one of the times that I feel most distinctly, like spiritually, I was walked through this process, this change process. So at this point in time, I had stopped going to church for a few years. Was not super into it. But on this day, I found myself in a church for the first time in a very long time. And I was not appreciating what the pastor was saying. Was not particularly feeling it. Did not feel the music that day. It was not speaking to me. And so I put my head down like I was praying, but mostly just so I could have excuse to close my eyes and not pay attention. If you've done one of those, like, I'm going to pray. And so I start daydreaming, and I'm thinking about, we were going to go see a soccer game later that day. I was thinking about the soccer game and trying to think through, like, what trains I was going to take. But then, you know, in my daydream, I just begin kind of talking with God. It's like an external conversation in my head, if that makes sense at all. And I just begin kind of processing aloud in my head the things I found hard in life right then. The things I disliked about what the pastor was saying. Which, permission, by the way. Uncertainty about what am I doing with my life right now. I remember just being like, I have no idea what I'm doing with my life right now. And then I felt kind of creeping into my awareness. It felt like it was moving from pre-contemplation into contemplation in that moment. Something I was feeling, but now was openly processing, was that regardless of my reservations and my affinity for that pastor, that I should connect with that church community. That I would like my life more. I would be more supported if I would commit there. Like, actually try to be part of that community. So I was like, you know what? I felt pretty aimless at that point. I'm game. My wife was down for it. So let's do it. That's what I thought. And then I said, realized, you know, I walked in. There's a retreat happening that weekend for young adults. And I was like, you know what? What I'll do is I'll go sign up for that retreat. If it still feels good, we'll figure out, like, if there's, like, a small group to be a part of. I kind of created a plan, preparation happening in my brain. So we sign up for the retreat that day, right there. We are tied in, made an action right there. I'm committing to this community. And then after that, we started going to the other, they had like a midweek group, Sunday services. It was like a maintenance. Like, I am building around me. I am maintaining this change in my life. I am going to live my life in community with other people. And the next thing I knew, I suddenly had this robust support system around me. I didn't agree with everybody around me. I didn't like the flavor of the church, but I had a support system for the first time in years. And then I think about that time in my life, and I think I changed in that year around there about as much as I've ever changed. And honestly, if you would have asked me on that day, what are the top 10 things you need to change? Being part of a church community would not even made the list. But it was the thing brought forward in that moment as the thing I needed to change. And it was absolutely the right thing. I think through all of those other changes I made, and none of them would have happened if I was not in a community of support. I would have thought of like 10 other things. I need to approach this, and 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 then maybe here I'll think about connecting with a church. But in that moment, I felt like God brought before me, he's like, I could care less about those 10 things. I want you connected to people. Change that now. Let's create a plan to do that. Let's create action. Let's create maintenance. And then I'm going to get to those other things in time. Some of those things I still haven't gotten to, but I'm trusting that God is interceding on my behalf right now because I got a lot of them I am trying to change. And here's the truth today. You have like 8 things wrong with you right now, minimum. Minimum. If you don't agree, that's one of those 8 things. Some of us have more. I'm probably in like the 20 to 30 range. But we can't work on all of those things at the same time. We need to tackle the thing that is the right thing before us. The one, maybe 2 things that we need to give ourselves towards right now so that we can be in a different place tomorrow than we are today. And so here at BLV, we don't see our role as highlighting those 30 or 40 things that we think is most likely to be wrong with you. And then telling you how you should correct those 30 to 40 things. That's not how we see our role. No, what we see our role to be is helping you walk a journey. Helping you figure out what that means for you. Helping you discover what is that right thing right now. And then helping you in a month, what is that right thing right then? And then a year, what is that right thing right then? And then when you're 85 years old and still trying to follow Jesus, what is that thing in 85 years? Trusting that God is good and patient enough that if I don't get to item 7 on my list until I'm 90 years old, he's still happy with me. Because it's not about me getting it perfect. It's about me being faithful and following through in what is being called for me today. And so we want to be a tool in your life, and we want to help give you tools to do that. And so we will not just stand up here and make moral absolute statements. That's a promise. You might walk out of here disappointed that Vince and I did not make something clear for everybody to hear. But we're okay with that. I am. I'm okay. Because more important to our mission of helping people find deeper, fuller lives, helping people find Jesus actually living in your life, helping you find real change that matters, is that we connect you with the God who already knows exactly what you need to work on right now, who's already interceding on your behalf, who has a wonderful plan to help you right where you are today, and is inviting you to cooperate with that. Not just so you can change, because that's required, but that you can change in the way that you're supposed to be changing right now. And here's the big thing. Then feel less anxiety in the meantime about all those other things that are still unchanged. The beauty of my experience of Jesus is that he invites us into a unique experience where change happens without shame. I know that seems like, of course, change should mean, I don't know if I can think of any examples in my life where I felt encouraged to change or I became aware of my need to change without feeling shame. My tendency to get defensive, my tendency to withdraw when I'm feeling hurt, my tendency to justify my actions if I'm not proud of them. All of those things I need to change, and I feel shame when I think about them. But what I experience in Jesus is a relief from shame. He doesn't want me to bring those to him because I'm so terrible. He doesn't want to bring those to him because he's just waiting for me to be like nice enough to hang out with. He wants good for me. He wants me to be less defensive because it sucks being defensive. He wants other people to enjoy my company and wants me to enjoy my own company. Because the reality is, he already does. And so, I think there's opportunity today. I think everybody here has the opportunity to be a different person tomorrow. and a different person the next day, and a different person the next day, and a different person the next day. But it's not going to be happening by me highlighting the things about your life that you should change. It's going to happen for you in a process of figuring out, what should I work on right now? And trusting that I am loved while those other things are on hold. And so what I'd love to do is, if you guys just want to stand with me, I'm going to pray to that end. Jesus, I love that you know how we work. I love that you invite us to follow you and not just instruct us on the rules of life. And so right now, Jesus, I ask with no shame that you would bring to mind right now, what is the thing I need to work on right now? Because the reality is there's a lot of them. What is the thing I need to bring right now and join in the work you're wanting me to do today? And particularly for those of us who have previous experiences with churches, usually the loudest thing in my mind is the one that I heard spoken on the most, is usually the thing that I felt the most shame about when I was younger. And Jesus, I pray for healing right now, that shame is not from you. You are gracious and you are compassionate. And Jesus, I pray that shame would feel washed away so that we could stand here on solid ground and actually take the steps forward you want us to. And so I pray, just like I experienced and have experienced so many times, you would bring to mind, almost from that pre-consciousness into consciousness, what is something to work on right now? What is the thing that feels bigger than me that I would like to see different? And what is the thing that you want us to look at? And then Jesus, I pray right now that we would feel a dose of grace, a dose of love, a dose of motivation and courage to tackle that. Not alone. Like we literally, the awareness of the people around us right now, we're not doing this alone. And I'm sorry if people in this room have been hurt in the past by this general approach of churches of preaching on the 40 mortal absolutes of the year, and you either like fall in line or you feel shamed because you fell out of line. That's not how you work, Jesus, and I am sorry, and I speak grace and forgiveness on you right now. And if any of us have realized, like, I've relapsed, I know I'm what I'm working on, but I have relapsed, I just break the power that shame has over that. That God, you are good, and as we celebrate next week, you bring to death all of our inequities, all of our shortcomings, and you constantly renew us to new life. And that would feel true. That wasn't a one-time thing. I don't experience a one-time thing. I experience that daily, minute to minute. I need to let this die again and renew again. And that would give us the strength and courage to keep moving forward on the things that matter most.